Hello and welcome to another edition of the Career Vision Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Piff, and we are recording again from the Career Vision offices here in Glen Ellyn. For those that don't know, Career Vision helps young people look for or figure out their career journey, having them take aptitude tests and their survey and then a consultation that kind of shows you what you're good at and some ideas of what you should do with your career. They also help people who are looking for a change, a career change or a job change. And that is going to be something we talk about here with our guest, Marv Ritter, who's here in Glen Ellyn with me at the Career Vision office. Hello, Marv.
Hi, how are you, Michael?
I'm doing good. And we talked a little off air about this, but we start every episode off with a shout out to your high school. So shout out to your high school, where you went, go mascot, whatever it is.
Okay, I'm from Winterset, Iowa. My high school was Winterset Community Senior High, and the mascot was the Huskies.
And what were you like in high school?
Gosh, I was kind of a nerd. you know, I didn't really have a sense of where I wanted to go with my life, and I was just like most kids, I guess.
So let's kind of talk about being, because a lot of us have very different definitions of a nerd. I'm also a nerd, but maybe in different ways. What were the things you were interested in?
Gosh, you know, cars, which I didn't have one, but well, eventually I got one, but it was a kind of a hand-me-down from my family. But I worked in the distributed education clubs. I think my senior year, maybe my junior year also, where you came to school like 7 or 7:30, had one class before everybody else started, and then you left an hour or so early at the end of the day, and you went to your job. And so I think that might have been 2 years for me, but quite a while ago.
So what did you, this is kind of like that job interview question, what do you want to do with your life? What did you think you were going to be doing while you were in high school? What did you think where your career was going to take you?
Well, I'm not sure that I really knew. My dad owned a insurance agency in this very small town, about 3,000 people, and he had actually taken it over from his father, and I think maybe the assumption was that I was going to do that too, and I just didn't know enough about it. But somewhere along the line, it was later in college, in graduate school, but I realized that, you know, I'm not really very interested in insurance, and I'm pretty sure that I don't want to live in a town of 3,000 people. I wanted to be in a bigger environment, and not sure what I thought about working for my dad, but anyway, the three of those things kind of came together, and it's like, I'm coming to Chicago.
Okay, Chicago. So where did you go to college?
Well, that's a funny story, too. I grew up in this really small rural town, and I didn't realize, or it never really hit me, that you could go to college outside of your own state. It sounds funny. I probably knew it because there were some kids that did, but most of them just stayed in small schools. And I went to Drake University for my undergrad, and then my senior year, I was just a couple credits short my last semester of graduating, so I started taking working towards my MBA, and so I just kind of rolled right into that and finished it in about a year and a half.
Nice, Drake. Go Bulldogs, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, you're correct about that.
Okay, so in college, were you kind of finding more of your interest or growing into what you think you wanted to do at that point?
Well, no, not really. My undergraduate, you know, I essentially had an insurance degree. I was one class short, and that was kind of the time frame when I was realizing I really don't want to do insurance. Drake was one of those few schools in the country that had an insurance major, and it just turned out that my faculty advisor was the head of the insurance department. It didn't hit me until years later, but of course, my dad knew him, and that's how that happened. But my junior year, I realized I I didn't want to go into insurance, and I didn't want to live in that small town. I just wanted a bigger environment. And so then I got a double major in marketing.
In marketing. So then what was next after that?
Well, then I started graduate school and specialized mostly in finance. And my first finance class for my MBA, I dropped out of that particular class about halfway through the semester. I just didn't get it. And the professor said to me, he said, you know, this isn't for everybody. And it was kind of a mean comment, but it really spurred me on. I came back the next semester, and I was the only person that he had ever had that got 100% on all of the exams for the semester. I must have killed myself trying to figure it out to prove him wrong.
I love the fuel of, this isn't for you. Well, let me show you. It's kind of interesting when someone says that, whether they're in like a faculty role or a management role of the this isn't for everyone. And you can kind of take it in different ways, yeah. Right? So you took it as a challenge.
I did. At first I'm like, how am I going to tell my parents that I've dropped out of this class? But after that, it was, okay, I'm going to show this guy I can do it.
Yeah. And I think there's something there to a lot of us would probably not think about dropping a class. Like I think it took me a while to realize that dropping a class isn't a bad thing, especially because you have to think about what it is you're working towards. So you're proving this, you know, professor wrong. Where do you go from there?
Well, the fall of graduate school, companies started coming to a Drake to interview, and I was fortunate enough to get an interview with a company called Anderson Consulting. Mm-hmm. They're the predecessor, if you will, to what's today known as Accenture. And myself and a couple other people from our class were offered jobs in Chicago.
Wow.
And so I took that job. It's probably, I don't know if it was the fall or the spring when that offer came, but we finished the graduate school program and took the kind of the final exams, I think maybe in July of that year. And then about 3 weeks later, I packed up a very small U-Haul because I didn't own very much stuff, and moved to here to Chicago.
So where in Chicago were you living then?
Well, for the first roughly year, I moved to a place called International Village in Lombard. It's
okay.
It's still there today.
It's still there, yeah.
And I picked that because a friend of mine from graduate school, who had also taken a job about a few weeks earlier, he moved there also. And, you know, I didn't know the western suburbs of Chicago, so I was like, okay, here's a big place. And I just got an apartment there, too. And we took the train down, and, you know, when we were in Chicago, but with a company like that, a big percentage of your time, you're Monday through Friday and, you know, in another state, in another somewhere.
What were you doing for Anderson Consulting at the time, and what was your day-to-day like?
Oh, that's a great question. So, you know, back then I was just a young kid. I didn't probably ask all the right questions, but almost everybody that started with us that summer had kind of the same story. We all thought we were going to come off or, you know, come to Chicago, work for Anderson and be business consultants. We were gonna help the CEOs and the, you know, the CFOs and those kind of people, you know, understand their business and help straighten it out. And, you know, about the first 2 or 3 weeks in, it became very clear to us that that really wasn't, you know, at least what our first few years were going to be. We were sent off to a big training facility in St. Charles that Anderson owned at the time. And we were there for 3 or 4 weeks learning to program in COBOL. And,
oh, interesting.
And I don't think anyone in that starting class that year, I don't think any single one of us had any idea whatsoever that we were going to be initially COBOL, you know, programmers. We just didn't know.
So for some, I know a little bit about COBOL from my father-in-law, but kind of explain to someone who doesn't know what that means.
Gosh, it's been so long. COBOL is just a fairly basic programming language that mm-hmm. you're able to program computers. And really what we were going to do is go out and the managers and the partners at Anderson, they were going to consult with the business leaders at our clients, mm-hmm. and we were going to design custom systems for them. Like, for example, I worked a lot in the finance industry, so for banks and helping them recreate their savings systems, their deposit systems, their lending systems. And back then, sometimes those systems were very custom to those banks, and so they'd be just coded from scratch. And then as time evolved, and this kind of shows my age here, but as time evolved, you know, companies, you know, big companies created more common software that okay. could be sold and modified by, you know, hundreds of different banks, mm-hmm. where, you know, we'd work for banks that might have a lot of branches, but, you know, this software was most likely specifically for their bank.
So as you're seeing technology and this, you know, these systems evolve, how were you kind of growing with it?
Well, I'm not sure that I didn't program for a very long okay. time, and it's probably a good thing. I wasn't very good at it, but I have a very detailed mind, and what I was very good at is thinking about the design of how these systems would work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, after a short stint, thank you, of programming, then I moved into roles where I would be working with our clients, understanding their business needs and turning those into designs
gotcha.
That then younger people would program, and often in COBOL, which is, I don't think, a language that's used very often anymore.
So how long were you at Anderson for?
I was at Anderson for 10 years.
Okay.
And it was probably one of the best things that ever happened for my career. Anderson teaches you, or Accenture would be the company now, but
yeah.
We learned to think very systematically and to plan and just take problems. So many times, as certainly as a very young person as Anderson, I would be sent to a client's location with usually a team of, you know, 15, 20, 30 people, mm-hmm. and to conquer whatever that process was. But I think we were probably always billed as, hey, here's Marv, he's an expert in X. I get there, I may not have known anything about X. sorry, Anderson or Accenture. But what the cool thing was, we got access to all the senior people
oh.
in the organizations. I'd be talking to the CEOs and the CFOs and those kind of people, and I was just a fairly young kid. And I was able to ask them all of the questions about what they wanted in these systems or mm-hmm. in these designs. And it's really funny, in a period of, you know, 1 or 2 months, I frequently, and the other people that work with me, we often knew more about that business than the full-time people that had been there for years and years, because they were in a role, if they didn't know it, they were afraid to ask the question because it was assumed that, hey, you've worked for the bank for 5 years,
yeah.
You should know the answer to this. And so mm-hmm. they didn't ask, and they just never learned. But we came in, they were spending, you know, probably millions of dollars for us to be there, And so we got that access. We could ask those questions. And I didn't feel silly asking the questions because I wasn't supposed to know. I was supposed to find out and figure out how they wanted to build their systems to meet those needs.
That's kind of a cool, like the on-the-job learning type thing, too. And I always, I've, in different roles that I've had, I've been labeled, you're a guru of this, you're an expert in this. I don't know any of that kind of stuff, but I'm going to learn along the way and then eventually be able to have a grasp for it, even though that thing's going to change, whether it's social media, digital media work, and things like that. So you've reached your 10 years there at Anderson. What happened next?
Wow. Well, at the end of Anderson, I had the opportunity to go to, I think, what might have been my dream job.
Wow.
I was asked to be the CIO, the chief information officer, for a trading firm downtown Chicago. But it wasn't just any trading firm. This was a company called Fawcett Corporation, and there was a number of subsidiary or sister companies, Marathon, Lakota, Larkspur. But all of these companies were owned by a man named Steve Fawcett. And Steve was just an incredible, optimistic man to work for. On the CBOE, I think at the time when I started, there were about the Chicago Board of Options Exchange.
Yeah.
I think there were about 1,000 seats, and hard to believe, but he owned like a little over 200 of them.
Oh, my goodness.
And so he made his business in buying these seats and leasing them out to traders, and floor traders, and then he would split the profit that they made in some way. I mean, each deal was different. But he also had a clearing firm that, if you were leasing one of his seats, and, you know, roughly a fifth of everybody down there was, you had to clear through him.
Oh.
And so clearing is I kind of think about it as kind of like your bank account. It's like, okay, last month you started out with $1,000, you wrote these checks and it went down for that, and then you got deposits of this, and here's where you are, you know, at the end of the month. And that happened every single day, because floor traders would be down there trading, and they make, you know, dozens or hundreds and sometimes even more trades every single day. And so anyway, I headed up technology for Steve, created a whole new department that almost didn't exist before then.
Wow.
And we did some really interesting things.
What were those conversations like where you are starting that new department for him? How, like, kind of what went into that?
Gosh, I don't know. Steve just gave me a really wide open, you know, here's what our business is about.
Uh-huh.
Here's the direction I think we should go. And that was kind of it.
Yeah.
And I went to work in the way that I had at Anderson, where I'd just go talk to traders and managers of this company, try to understand the things that they wanted to do. And I hired a large number of programmers and analysts. Several of them came with me from Anderson.
Okay.
And we just built a team did some pretty neat stuff.
So in that role that you're managing this team, right?
Yeah.
Had you been doing things like management before then, what were you kind of having to do? Like, what were you learning while you're putting this team together?
Absolutely. So the last half of my career, you know, the last 5 years at Anderson, I was a manager and then a senior manager there.
Uh-huh.
And so I'd always have, you know, big projects going it wasn't a whole lot different, other than I was the guy that was at the, you know, I didn't have a partner above me at this point. I was that person. So, but after Fawcett, Steve ultimately we changed some things in the business, and there were a couple rough days. I mean, this is the kind of business that any given day, you know, the business is going up and down by very, very significant numbers. But ultimately, Steve introduced me to a guy named Blair Hall. And Blair owned a company, also a trading company at the CBOE and other exchanges too. But Hall Trading, it was a pretty small company. It was about 120 people maybe at the end. And I came over to initially to help manage some technology products. And we were building systems that, you know, they're, I think, fairly common these days, but systems that would watch the market. And we were looking for, you know, for a very small change in price of a security, and, you know, an eighth of a point. And we weren't looking for where might it be, you know, a month from now or 6 months from now. We're trying to figure out where is it going to be, you know, 5 to 10 seconds from
now. Wow.
Okay. And so we built systems that could watch feeds from a lot of different markets and help us determine where our mathematical calculations thought that these things would go. And at any point in time, if we thought that there was going to be a, you know, a change, you know, very small change in it, our systems would buy $50,000 of that. And it could be, you know, 2 minutes later, it's selling it because now it, you know, the markets just went up and down. But ultimately, at Hull, we ended up buying a company from someone else that did electronic stock execution on the floors of mostly of options exchanges. And so on option floors back then, you had traders that were trading all day long. And once they made that option trade, they wanted to either buy or sell the same stock that the option was in to hedge their trade. And so this particular company, we purchased it, and I'm not sure why, but I became the president of that company. And so, you know, and I was still pretty young. I'm not even sure how old I was. Let's see, 23. I might have been 30. Gosh, I might have been 33, 34 years old.
You are younger than I am now. Yeah. And your resume is extremely impressive at this point.
It's a little scary. And I didn't plan this. This stuff just kind of happened. But I became president of this company. We renamed it, Electronic Stock Execution Systems. Uh-huh. They moved me out of our building, which was the building just, I think it's just south of the Sears Tower or whatever they call it now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that tall building. If you're driving in the Eisenhower, it's got the, I call it the birthday cake on the top. It's all lit up.
Oh, I know exactly which one that is.
Beautiful building. And in fact, I designed all of our floor space in that. For 1 year at Hull, not only was I overseeing some technology systems, they knew I had some experience with real estate, and so I spent about a year designing two new floors in that building, you know, for Hull to move in. And then when that was over, that's about the time that we bought this company, Electronic Stock Execution Systems, or we renamed it to that, and somehow I became president of that. So at that point in time, they were like, okay, we need to separate these two businesses, and we need more space. So I once again moved to another building there on Wacker Drive. It wasn't nearly as nice as the space in where Hull was. It was... Actually, when I think about it, it was kind of drab, but we had a team of, I'm not even sure, maybe about a dozen people that worked for this company in that floor space, and they were mostly programmers that kept these systems up, but we had terminals. These were really dumb terminals. They weren't, you know, like a computer is today, but dumb terminals that ran on a DEC VAX computer, and we had them on the floors of every options exchange in North America. So the CBOE, the Amex, the we had them on the New York Stock Exchange, the Boston Stock Exchange, the Philadelphia, and the Pacific.
Wow.
And in order to do that, because I was the senior executive of that company, I had to go out and get my securities license, and you know, which was a little bit foreign to me, but I went out and got that license, and I became a member of the New York Stock Exchange, the American, the Boston, the Philadelphia, the Pacific exchanges.
Wow.
And you know, again, I think I was probably 34 years old, and it was a little bit overwhelming, but pretty exciting.
So were you visiting these places then, as you know?
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, mostly I was based in Chicago. But what happened is I went out to the New York Stock Exchange to see our staff there, my staff, I guess.
Yeah.
They worked on the floor of those exchanges. And so they were the people that were executing these orders to buy or sell the stock, mm-hmm. that the folks on the floor of the CBOE or, you know, Pacific Exchange, wherever they were, wanted to hedge their trades. And so we had terminals on those floors, and they were, you know, just executing this stuff. And so I was on a United Airlines flight coming back from New York, and I'm reading the magazine because,
yeah.
you know, we didn't have cell phones and, you know, or Blackberries, or, you know, you couldn't get to the internet. That I don't think that even existed.
Were they even doing in-flight movies then?
Well, yeah, they had in-flight movies, okay. but you were seeing it on a screen. But anyway, so I'm reading the United Airlines magazine, and I see an ad in the back for this little computer. It ran MS-DOS. It was the size of your cell phone, and it flipped up, you know, kind of like an old flip phone did, and it had a keyboard there and then a small screen. It had something called a PCMIA card,
uh-huh.
slot, which was kind of a slot that might be about 2 inches wide, an inch
yeah.
and a half wide, and so you could plug things into that slot, and there was this thing coming out that it was, nobody really knew anything about it, but it was wireless networks. And these wireless networks, there were cards that were available that you could put in a PCMI slot.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that this little laptop, it wasn't a laptop, it was like a little calculator with a screen on it. But it would run MS-DOS, and I also knew that the DEC VAX ran on a different operating system, but there were software systems out there that could convert that software to MS-DOS.
Okay.
So I landed. The next day we ordered half a dozen of these little handheld PCs to just test them. We bought the PCMI card. It took an antenna that you had to have in your space to make it wireless.
Okay.
And we converted the software, and we were able to create a little screen, which kind of matched the screen that we already had running on these DEC VAXs. And you could key in, you know, I want to buy, you know, 10,000 shares of IBM,
mm-hmm.
or I wanted to sell 10,000 shares of IBM. And so we got permission from the CBOE to put an antenna down there, and that took a little while, but certainly Blair Hull and the senior people at Hull Trading, you know, helped push that forward.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I developed this. We even, to get the battery pack, you know, this took, I think, either two or four probably AAA batteries, I found a company in Cedar Rapids that manufactured batteries, and they would do them in any way you wanted. So I had them put C and D cells, two different size packs, together. They'd shrink wrap around them, and we had them put, believe it or not, a trailer hitch connection from a car as a pigtail coming off. And in our office, we got good with soldering guns, and we soldered the, you know, the male and the female, you know, on there.
Yeah.
And we had a pigtail coming out of this battery, and we bought RC remote-controlled cars and planes and stuff. They had little battery chargers.
Okay.
And we bought... not those. I mean, this was put together with, as I talk about it, kind of, you know, tape and string kind of thing. But we put them together. We'd charge these battery packs. You know, it would be, I think, four D cells or four C cells. Every night, we'd charge those. In the morning, our traders would come up. And so when I say this, it's kind of hard for me to believe, but I created the very first handheld device, the handheld stock execution device anywhere in the world.
Wow.
And we put it down on the CBOE, and eventually we put it on all the other options exchanges. And on a daily basis, my little tiny company, and again, I wasn't the owner, just, you know, I was the president of the company.
Yeah.
On a daily basis, we executed roughly 1% of the New York Stock Exchange daily volume almost every single day.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was because of that volume is driven by the, you know, the options traders. But it was pretty exciting time.
How were the people reacting to that around you as you're basically innovating, you know, there with them?
Well, I can tell you, the people at Hull Trading, they were pretty excited about
it. Yeah, I bet.
but we'd give it to not only Hull Trading clients, mm-hmm. or Hull Trading employees, but we would give it to our clients of electronic execution systems. So.
Mm-hmm.
All the clients that we previously had that were standing in a pit and signaling off to somebody 20, 30, 40 feet away to, hey, buy this or sell this, what they did is they had this little handheld. They had the battery pack in their pocket. You know, you have to wear a jacket down there. They're kind of colored jackets with big pockets. So they put the battery pack in that pocket, and this little wire came out. It's maybe a couple feet long, you know, plugging the battery in. They knew that they were going to trade an option. You know, that was their next thing. And they would set up the hedge mm-hmm. on that. All they had to do as soon as they made the trade is push the enter key. And a fraction of a second later, it was in New York. And my company had electronically executed the hedge for them. So it took an enormous amount of risk out for them.
Well, so at this time, what year is it when this is all happening? Just so we can kind of have an idea.
Probably around 1990, maybe a little, might have been a little earlier than that. sorry, it's just been too long.
I know. And I'm wondering, because I heard it a little bit in there as you were talking about, you know, real estate also designing floors. Was there an inkling or a little bit of interest into what you do now during this time period?
Well, yeah, probably. As I grew up, my dad, he owned an insurance company, but he also owned a couple rental houses and a small farm. We lived in town. Somebody else lived on the farm. But so as a kid, I was in and out of these rental homes every now and then. With my dad. And I don't remember a whole lot about it, but somehow when I got to Chicago, I was very interested in real estate, and I started buying single-family homes,
mm-hmm.
and mostly here in Glen Ellen, and back then they were, you know, my first home was, I think, $50,000 or $52,000.
Wow.
And But anyway, I started buying these homes, and I ended up at one point, a few years into it, I had acquired maybe five or six of these homes, and it occurred to me that, you know, this is great, but I'm going at this at a pretty small scale, and so I started looking for opportunities for apartment buildings, and you know, sometimes timing is just right for you, but I ended up buying, over the course of, well, 2 or 3 years, 96 apartments in Naperville. And these were brand new apartments, never been lived in. And I thought, wow, this would be great. You know, no maintenance, you know, they're brand new. What didn't hit me with the first two that I bought was, okay, they're 100% empty. You got a big mortgage going. And, you know, I'm not sure what happened, but there was a bank out there that, you know, they initially essentially financed the entire thing for these first two buildings. And
then
that was back when interest rates were probably, I think it was in 1986, I think interest rates were maybe 12.5% on these commercial deals. And, you know, my first deal was 2 12 flats right next door to each other. It was a street with, I'm going to have 10 buildings there. Mm-hmm. I bought the first two. And then what happened was over the next 2 or 3 years, interest rates came down, you know, maybe 1%, you know, a year. I don't remember exactly, but if I go back to my MBA days in that finance class, this maybe ties it all together and unique for me here. I was really good with an HP-12C, which you can use to, it's a calculator, which you can use to figure out mortgage payments. And I became fascinated with, oh my gosh, look what happens when the interest rate goes down, you know, 1% on $1 million, what happens? And all of a sudden the value of the property that you had just went up. And so what happened was the rate went down. I refinanced those units. I took the money out of that as the down payment for the next one. And before I knew it, instead of two of these buildings, I owned 8 of the 10 on the street. There were 12 flats, so 96 units. And then the developer of those units, I never did get to buy the last two, by the way, but the developer of those units, he built a 60 unit building just like a block away. And he had them, he was running them for, oh, probably 3 or 4 years. And he called me one day, and he and I never, we didn't always see eye to eye, but he said to me, you know, we're having difficulty managing these. Would you be willing to manage them? And I said yes. And we had a management person in place that worked for us.
Yeah.
But I said yes, and he actually was going to pay us to do that. And I was thinking all along, I mean, I was thrilled that he would pay us, but I was also thinking, oh my gosh, if I could just get a hold of those 56 units or 60 units and just raise the rent, that would allow my 96 units, it'd allow me to raise ours further,
gotcha,
too. And so I probably, if he would have just said, hey, would you manage these, I probably would have offered to do them for free.
Yeah.
Knowing that I could, you know, then move my rents to where we thought the market should be.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's kind of my background on, I don't know how I got started, but I owned those units for I think 27 years. It was a fascinating time.
Well, it's interesting. You've gotten to see this area grow, Glen Ellen, Naperville, this west suburban area that we're in right now. So, how does that turn into the business that you are a part of now? How did that kind of grow into that at that point?
Sure, that's another one of those stories. one of the houses that I had bought after I got here, I was over on Rayford Road here in Glen Ellen, and I'd been in the house for about 10 years, kind of worked on remodeling it. I wasn't particularly good at doing it, but I'd bring people in to help here and there. And in the house, I put a primary bathroom suite in the master, and then I converted a closet to a fireplace. And again, I'm 30 years old, and not thinking about everything quite right. And I ended up getting married, and my wife moves into the house, and she said something along, "Well, where's the closets?" I mean, she obviously knew before we got married, but she says there aren't any closets in this house, because there used to be when there wasn't a master bathroom suite, and when there wasn't a fireplace in the bedroom. And so we hired an architect over in Wheaton to work with us to design an addition to this house. And I think big about most things. And the addition that we designed, Debbie, my wife, would say that I designed, was quite a bit bigger than the existing house. And it was fairly expensive. It was going to be a big undertaking, but it's like, this is the right thing to do. And a woman that just dear to my heart, named Ginny Scatterday, she was the manager of the Baird & Warner here in Glen Ellen, and for many, many years. And she also happened to be my neighbor across the street. And she and her husband, John, when I moved into that house 10 years earlier, I was 23, 24, and I think they thought, oh, my God, there's going to be drug parties and beer parties and all kinds of stuff, and which there weren't. Certainly had a party here and there, but not like that. But she and John kind of adopted me. I mean, literally if there was a holiday, I wasn't going back to Iowa, I was at their house. Sunday night after everybody got done mowing their yards, they'd almost always invite me over in the summer. Hey, we're going to do a barbecue or whatever. But where was your question?
We're getting to the how the business developed from there.
So anyway, Jenny, after we designed this big addition for the back of the house, and we had interviewed a couple builders to do it, Jenny just gave me kind of a gut check. She says, there's a new house that I'd like you to see, and I, of course, wasn't real interested in that. I kind of mentally invested in this addition. But my wife, my new wife, she was interested. And so I, for whatever reason, we ended up buying it. And so a day or two later, I'm talking to the builder that had spent an enormous amount of time working through, what would it take to build this house, the cost, and, everything that was involved. And I said to him something about, I'm sorry that we ended up buying another house. And my wife would say, Debbie would say, kind of verbal vomit happened. And, and you might think, what the heck is verbal vomit?
I'm well known for the verbal vomit,
It's when you say something that you never intended, it just all of a sudden just erupted out. And I said, and I think, looking back at it, I'm pretty sure it was an effort to make him feel better about this. But I said, if you ever get a project that's bigger than you can do on your own, why don't you give me a call? Because the good news is the house we bought was less than what the addition was going to be, and maybe there's something we could do together. And Debbie would say, maybe there was an omen there. 2 or 3 weeks went by, nothing happened. And then one day, this gentleman, his name is Walt Arway, he called me. And he said, when you were talking to me about buying the new house, you said something about if there's a project, da-da-da.
Yeah.
And So we set up a meeting, and for, I'd say, probably about 6 months, we got together about once a week in the evening, just, you know, because I was still in the corporate world, kind of trying to figure out, is there something we could do together? And we decided that, you know, we should explore, you know, building spec homes. And so anyway, we formed a partnership, and that was roughly 35 years ago. And for the first 20 years, he and, you know, ran the day-to-day. I was in the corporate world, and, you know, I didn't work there. I just, you know, my role was, you know, I could fund projects, but I couldn't build them, and he could build them, but he couldn't fund them. So we fit together really well. And this is the kind of business that, you know, there's a lot of ways that if you have a builder that doesn't have integrity or mm-hmm. the right things, they could take advantage of you. Not that in Walt at all. Couldn't be more honest, more straightforward, more knowledgeable person about building homes. And so for the first 20 years, we'd build, you know, one house at a time. Build it, sell it, buy another lot somewhere. We weren't the first people to do teardowns in Glen Ellen, but our first teardown, I think, was in 92.
Okay.
And so pretty early on, and I remember it well, we bought this house for just under $100,000, and we closed on it, and I'm like, oh my gosh, Walt, what have we done? We bought this perfectly good house, and we're going to tear it down.
What area was this in? Just curious.
It was over on Spring Avenue.
Okay.
So, almost everything for the last 35 years that we've done, the bulk of it is in Glen Ellen. Mm-hmm. We build within a 8 to 10 mile radius of Glen Ellen, but most of it has been in Glen Ellen and Wheaton. We've built in Elmhurst. We've built in St. Charles and Clarendon Hills and other places, but we tend to concentrate kind of in our own homeland.
Just curious, because I live in the neighborhood. Anything in the Raintree area? Just curious.
I don't think we've built down by Raintree. We've done a couple renovations, additions.
Okay.
Down there, but not a new home.
Okay. I know it's a very old neighborhood, and we moved there 5 years ago, but that's a totally different podcast. Yeah. We're back to so in the corporate world, what kind of made you think, I think it's time to make the other thing full time now?
I never thought that.
No.
And to this day, I never intended to work at Right Way Custom Homes.
So how did it happen?
Well, after I left the trading world, I worked for a company. It was over in Naperville, but it originally had started here in Glen Ellen, and it was a marketing research firm. And I went there to be their CIO of their North American business. And within probably about 2 months, what I didn't realize is they didn't really hire me to be the North American CIO. They wanted to try me out maybe for mm-hmm. a couple months, but I became the CIO for this global organization, and I helped them grow from a $200 million business to a $1 billion business.
Wow.
And then we were part of a company called WPP, which is one of the largest advertising conglomerates in the world. And our company, Millward Brown, was part of the largest group of WPP. I mean, we owned, Ogilvy and Mather and J. Walter Thompson and, you know, some pretty big advertising agencies. But Kantar was the largest of all of those. And at some point in time, the work that I did, I sponsored, I was kind of one of two people that created a shared technology group across all of Kantar. So we were servicing about 30,000 people around the world in a little over 100 countries. And so that was my role. I was the CTO of that, the chief technology officer of that particular company. And eventually, what happened to me, I think, happened to a lot of people. They get to kind of that mid-50s, if they will.
Yeah.
They're, I don't want to say making too much money, because you probably never could. If you work hard, you should get paid for it.
Yes.
But I made a fair amount of money, and I think companies like that are looking for that kid that's me 30 years younger,
yeah,
that 25-year-old kid, that dramatically less expensive and, you know, comes with new technologies and ideas, just doesn't have the background of experience.
Right.
So for the first year or so, I talked about, hey, you know, when I left the corporate world, and I took a year off after that. I'd been to Europe or Asia at least once a month for 16 years, and I just wanted to refresh my batteries. But I talked about it as, okay, when I left the corporate world, but now today, you know, 15 years later, I'm more wiser and knowledgeable and understand the world a little bit better. I didn't leave the corporate world. The corporate world left me. And so I've cleaned that up in my repertoire. The corporate world left me. And I took that year off. And after, I don't know, close to the end of that first year, I'm thinking, okay, I need to go out, figure out what I'm going to do, you know, when I grow up. And and I realized that my wife wasn't used to me being at home. So I thought, well, I'll go over to the Right Way office. We've got this beautiful office downtown Glen Ellen. And, you know, it's just, you know, a mile away from my house. I'll just go over there.
Yeah.
And I'll spend that time, you know, just, you know, working on my resume, setting up interview calls, just doing all the things that you do in a job search, because that's, I thought, I'm going to go back. I'm going to be a CIO somewhere, and didn't know where. And I worked on that for, I don't know, a number of months. But what I discovered was, although I knew I wanted to stay in the workforce, I couldn't work on my resume and setting up coffees and working on LinkedIn and stuff. I couldn't do that 8 or 10 hours a day. I could do it 4 or 5 hours a day, but after that, I kind of burned out. But while I was at the Right Way office, I identified things that I felt like, hey, we ought to be doing, but we just don't have the right, you know, enough manpower or the right skill sets or whatever it might be. And I've got these big corporate skills into this relatively small organization, and I'd owned this company at the time for 20 years, but I just never really worked in it on a day-to-day basis. So out of curiosity and time availability and whatever, I just started doing some of these little things. Most of them related to marketing, some of them, you know, related to designing houses or, you know, whatever it might be. And I found that I liked that, and after a short period of time of doing that, I went home one night and I said to my wife, you know, I don't think I'm going to go back to the corporate world. I think I'm going to do this. And to her credit, she said, that sounds great. Go do it. So the next morning, I show up at the Right Way office and I say to Walt and Terry Smith Pfeiffer, our CFO, I go, I don't think I'm going back to the corporate world. I'm just going to work here. And you could just almost see it in their face. They're like, oh my gosh, we never, ever anticipated that. I think they were a little bit, uh-oh, you know. But, and I was, you know, it was what I wanted to do. I realized I had this passion. And they weren't, you know, they were used to working without me physically there, you know, on a regular basis. You know, I'd talk to them on the phone or stop in to sign checks or something, but, you know, I was never really there in the previous 20 years. So I think it was a little bit of a shock for them. But as we look, it's been about, I think maybe 14 years now. As we look back at it, it was just part of the driving succession of what, you know, we needed to just propel our business forward. And if I think that we could look back at that moment in time, knowing what we know now, I don't think they'd have that reaction of, you know, they didn't say it, by the way. It was just what I could see on their face.
But
knowing what we know now and what they know now about this, if we went back 14 years and that happened again, they'd be, I think, mostly elated. There might be some things they'd like changed, but it's just been a wonderful partnership. And, you know, between Walt and Terry and the rest of our team that works with us full time, I couldn't be more excited. This turns out to be my passion that I just never realized it was there.
I kind of love hearing that in your voice. You know, feeling passionate about that. So for someone, I know we time has flown here, so I'm sorry for taking up so much of your time here. But for someone who is interested in couple of the facets of your career, but really where you are now, what advice would you have for that person? Or you, I guess, what, you know, 40 years ago?
Yeah. Well, I've got kids that are 29 and 30, and so to them and their kids, I end up talking to them a fair amount, and it's really clear to me. And this is the aha, the surprise of, you know, what happened to me. You know, owning Right Way for 20 years with never a thought that this would become my career, that, you know, this was just an investment. You know, I was mostly passive. At any age, wherever you are, you'll always have the situation or the possibility of it happening that you become 50. You can become 55, and the corporate world realizes that there's someone half your age that can do three-quarters of your job for 10% of your salary, or, you know, whatever the math is there, right? But at some point in time, almost everybody changes positions or loses positions. And so my best advice is find something that you're interested in, a little tiny business idea, and start it now. Mm-hmm. Do it just in your spare time, in the evening, an hour a week, a couple hours on the weekend, something. It could be starting an Amazon business, as simple as that. Or my son, his first introduction to being an entrepreneur is I had a power washer, and I suggested that he try power washing. Yeah. And so for a summer up in Door County, he did that. For a few of our neighbors up there, and I remember him. His first thought was, "Oh my gosh, Dad, look how much money I made in 4 hours doing power washing." Mm-hmm. Versus he was an instructor at the teaching kids how to sail at a yacht club up there, and you know he was making, you know, maybe $10 an hour doing that versus this. And you know, I pointed out to him, unfortunately, you can't power wash, you know, 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day every day. But it was that first, hey, being an entrepreneur. So think about that, what you could start now, that work a little bit at it, you know, every week, every month, every year, and 5 years out from now, or maybe 10 years, or whatever that time frame is for you, you will have 5 years or 10 years experience and expertise in that little niche that you developed. And there's thousands and thousands of business opportunities out there. So find that one that has interest to you. Build up your expertise that gives you the option sometime in the future that if you wanted to, you could make it your full-time career. Much better to start out with a business you've been in 10 years than you just got laid off of your current job and you're just figuring out what that business might be today.
Marv, this has been a lot of fun and listening to your story, and I feel like I could talk to you forever. So thank you very much for taking the time to do this. And also thank you to Career Vision for letting us take up an office to talk. And people can learn more about Career Vision at careervision.org, or they can listen back to all our episodes on WGNradio.com. For Marv Ritter, I'm Michael Piff. Thanks very much.